Let me back up a little bit. I am actually really pleased that at the break, nearly everyone wanted to say, but wait a minute, Hegel can't be right here. That there's a great anxiety about this. And I'm not going to try to dissuade you at the moment. First thing I want to say is, this should be deeply uncomfortable. And it should be deeply uncomfortable because if you remember in the introduction, the premise of Hegel's entire analysis is we Kantians. And he assumes that he's addressing we Kantians. And we're finally been reading this narrative, and now we've come to ourselves as one of its objects. So this is the moment when we Kantians, we Fichteans, and we Romantics, this is the chapter that's about us. And therefore, it is in this chapter where either we are going to undergo a conversion or find ourselves repelled by Hegel's system. So it is exactly here where I'd expect most of you, either here or in conscience or the beautiful soul, to find yourself unwilling to follow Hegel. Right? Because the deepest structure of us modern self-conscious beings is Kantians. I think we are all knee-jerk Kantians. And not to think in a Kantian way is actually deeply uncomfortable. And I want to say that's the structure of the world. The world, as it were, leads us to be Kantians and to have that kind of stoic Kantian view about ourselves in the world. So that's the first thing I want to say, and that's why, that's the whole point of Lukács's History and Class Consciousness. That Kantianism gives us the metaphysical structure of the modern world. And to understand Marx, you have to think what it means to get, so he thinks what he calls the antinomies of bourgeois thought are simply the antennas of Kant's philosophy. So Lukács sees no gap at all between bourgeois thought, that is what it means to be a modern subject, and Kantianism. So the first thing is I want to say we all, and I mean all of us, somewhere have Kantian intuitions. And so your response to what I just said, and wanting to say, oh, come on, at least give me an infinite task. Give me a break. It's great. Here's the second thought. The one place that Adorno thinks that Kant is right, but has to be reinterpreted, is exactly over the idea of the moral non-coordination between virtue and happiness. That there's a passage, and you know, there's that famous passage in Critique of Judgment, right? And I think he mentions Spinoza. And he says, you know, I mean, I guess everyone thinks, or a lot of us think, when we imagine Spinoza, we actually imagine the most virtuous, decent, purely moral being. He looks like, you know, no one could write the ethics other than, you know, the perfectly virtuous soul. Right? And the thought that, you know, Spinoza and Tony Soprano end up in the same place is morally unintelligible. Right? It's morally unintelligible. So that coordination problem between happiness and virtue of generating a moral image of the world, Adorno argues, is actually the project of revolutionary thought. That is what, and this is a whole tradition, it's in Lucian Goldman, who's a student of Lukács, it's in a whole series of philosophers who takes Kant's postulates and transform it into a philosophy of history. So the way you can turn Kant into a Marxist is instead of thinking about God coordinating virtue and happiness, how about revolutionary action coordinated virtue and happiness. And in a way, you say, so and you can find this in you'll see a version of this in Yovel's book on Kant's philosophy of history, argues this idea of taking all of this into the philosophy of history. And there's bits of Kant that say you can deal with the same problems that come up in the postulates in terms of history, in terms of history making. So they need not be, and the point of making it historical is to say the object of moral striving need not be infinitely remote. It can be pretty remote, as utopias tend to be, but it need not be infinitely remote. So it can be an object of real striving and real attempt to coordinate these things. And that's what the role of the artwork in Adorno, just to pull this together, is to give us the idea. I mean, the artwork for Adorno is the promise of happiness. What he means is reason and happiness can be coordinated, that is, universal in particular can be coordinated. So the actuality of the artwork is the promise of the possibility. So instead of the postulates, you have artworks whose actuality promises the possible coordination of universal and individual reason and happiness. Okay, so there are ways in which you can take this up and do historical things with them. But what Hegel will always object to is that I'm pulling the bar. And the reason he's always going to object to the bar is because Kant's theory constitutes nature as morally empty. And by constituting nature as morally empty, as essentially disenchanted, it generates a gap that cannot ever be truly crossed. So another way, just to give you other sides of this problem, we'll go back to Hegel, another way of thinking about this is it true that nature is essentially morally empty? Well, the belief that nature is essentially morally empty, I want to say, is a Christian belief. That is, there are ways of thinking about it, and this is, by the way, what John McDowell means. I mean, McDowell's whole program is to say, no, nature is not morally empty. Actually, nature is actually fine if you have the idea that there's a notion of nature that is not determined by science. So is there a conception of nature, right, that's objective and true, but not constituted by natural science? And that's what Adorno and McDowell and people like that are trying to do. They're trying to say, no, there's ways of thinking about human embodiment and our natural environment, and the fact that we are natural beings that are themselves, right, part of our moral fabric. This moment, which is uncomfortable, is a nexus. This is really where all these things we've been worrying about really are coming home, and where you're going to find different ways through it, including not always Hegel's, and where some people are going to just say, I know the costs are high, but I'll take the Kantian cost. So that most of the Kantians I know will say, well, yeah, there are some of these problems in Kant, but anything else is disastrous. Because anything else gives up self-legislation. Right?
Because remember,
the bar comes from the principle of freedom, negativity, self-legislation. If you think reason is a spring of action, then you want two springs of action, and then it's all going to happen all over again. So this really is a crux. Suitably uncomfortable. Should we press on? Okay. So here's the first step in Hegel's worry. Is that this version of morality, the moral view of the world, think of Heidegger on the Age of the World picture. When I say the moral view of the world. Because part of the problem here, according to Hegel, is that morality is here being driven by its representational character. And this will become the center, by the way. This is going to be that problem. The problem here is the problem of representation is going to be central to Hegel's critique of religion. The problem of religion is not its content, it's that it conceives its content in representational terms and therefore misconceives itself. And it's not an accident when people, a kid on the elevator after my lecture at Auschwitz says, so doesn't Kant necessarily believe in God? I don't know, there's no run-up to this. We weren't talking about that. He just suddenly turned to me. You know what to say. I said, well, there's some Kantians who, I just did the liberal thing. But for Hegel, it's not an accident that this comes out as a theological moment because of its representational structure of the infinite. Right? It's a version of the unhappy consciousness problem. So morality here is always posited as a beyond, and that moral metaphysics, you might say, is as deep as our belief in representational thought. Well, what is it that secures representational thought? Well, that's going to be a question for the rest of the book. But at least here, in a narrow way, you can say if thinking involves judgment, and that's what Kant thinks, then you are going to end up with a moral metaphysics. That is, if you think judgment, rather than speculation, for example, is the fundamental mental act, then you are going to have a representational picture of truth and therefore of the world as a whole. Now, ultimately, I'm going to argue that this problem of representational thought is the problem of time. But we'll get to that when we get to absolute nihilism. Kant, for Hegel, however, is the avatar of a broken modern philosophy, because he is the last avatar of representational thinking. So you may say that all the post-Kantians are really anti-representational, right? Which is why, again, as we talked about last week, that Nolsi and Coulibart can think of the Romantics as, you know, proto-deconstructionists, that people now think of Fichte as, you know, the great radical, and so on. And that's because they're anti-representational. Their freedom has a different kind of non-representational structure. So in paragraph 614, Hegel says, Since, however, in the third place, I remember the first place, it is a single self, it is in itself or implicitly the unity of duty and reality. This unity therefore becomes an object for it as its perfect morality, but as a beyond of its reality, yet a beyond that ought to be actual. So once you do the positing, the postulating itself, the construction of an object, generates you into this representational habit. And that will get you into this notion of, and here, as I said, the structure now is you must think two things simultaneously. That both, that you are, in your soul, in your very constitution, a moral being, right? Someone who is commanded by the moral law. And that the postulate that you never reach is there is no morality. Because once you achieve that perfect ordination, there's no ought and there's no morality. So the goal of morality is there be no morality. And it's this problem that somehow Kant wants both the thought that we are moral beings and that we ought to somehow be more than moral beings is what's going to be the cause of dissemblance and duplicity. That you're always going to be shifting away from your own commitments. So Hegel's thought here, and it's an interesting thought, he's not claiming that the Kantian can't be moral exactly. I think his argument is that it can't be authentic. It can't be true to itself. So in paragraph 617, oh yeah, I never know what I'm going to read. My notes say go to paragraph 617. I'm just hoping it's going to cash out. It does this time. I'm a little surprised I have to kind of shift the way I phrase it. The way, so the third sentence, the way in which consciousness proceeds in this development. And this, by the way, is going to be the model of the whole unpacking of it. So this is the basic structure of dissemblance and duplicity here, that he then runs through each of the postulates, which I won't do in detail. So the way in which consciousness proceeds in this development is to establish one moment and to pass directly from it to another, setting aside the first. But now, as soon as it has set up this second moment, it also sets it aside again and really makes the opposite moment the essential one. So the question is, just to give the example here, and I'll go on, what's essential? The infinite striving or the realization? So it looks like it's committed to both, and it can't hold them together consistently. And that it can't hold them together consistently is going to generate a version of bad faith. So, at the same time, it is also aware of its contradiction. Right, as Adam rightly said, it's not that Kant doesn't know this, right? And its shiftiness. For it passes from one moment immediately in relation to this very moment over to the opposite. Because a moment has no reality for it, it posits that very same moment as real, or what comes to the same thing in order to assert one moment as possessing being in itself. It asserts the opposite as the one that possesses being in itself. In so doing, it confesses that, as a matter of fact, it is in earnest with neither of them. We must examine more closely the moments of this insincere shuffling. So the problem with Kant, he says, this paragon of virtue and morality and duty, it's all kind of insincere, dissembling, and shuffling. I mean this, I mean that. So, let's just take the obvious case. Let's start again with poor Scott. Since I can think of no more reason to let him off the hook. I can see he's miserable. I go that. He actually seems happier. Okay. Now wait a minute. I've now achieved morality and happiness. Where's the problem? Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not all of morality and all of happiness. It's just one moment. So what's really important is not that you achieve it here and now. It's that there be this total coordination of morality and happiness. So I have to, as it were, deflect the seriousness of this single moment and say, no, no, no. It's the deep one that is really important. But once I do that, then you say to me, oh, so you don't care about Scott. No, I say, no, Scott. And then, oh, no, he's happy. I'm happy. So the question, the thing that Hegel wants to press on us, and it's so obvious, is that sometimes, indeed lots of times, there is a coordination between morality and happiness. We routinely achieve our ends. The world's not perfect. It doesn't mean there's this overall, blah, blah, blah. But the question is, what do I have to believe here to believe that there's a metaphysical problem? In order to sustain the idea of a metaphysical problem, I have to dissemble my own moral achievements and count them as nothing. Right? And only make the object of ultimate morality the crux of the matter. So I keep going back and forth by saying, oh yeah, I know I did a morally good thing, but really. So what Hegel then worries about is that there's no way of settling that. So that's problem one. Problem two, still staying with the first posture. What is exactly, so you say, okay, you say to me, I'll grant you that sometimes there is this coordination, and, I can see that, but there's this problem. How about the Spinoza problem? The Tony Soprano Spinoza problem. Surely the world is morally out of control. Surely that's enough for you to now want to posit that ultimate object and not simply settle with being knights the scum. Paragraph 622. Is it paragraph 622? No, I'll jump ahead. I see what I've done. Okay, let's do paragraph 625, and I'll work back to those earlier ones. So he says here, let's try to analyze what it is you're exactly worried about in the Spinoza-Soprano scenario. He says, it is claimed that experience shows that in this present world, the moral individual often fares badly while the immoral individual often flourishes. But the intermediate state of an imperfect morality, which has shown itself to be the essential one, that's Hegel's line. Hegel's line is, the world's not morally perfect, but it's not radical evil either. It's not an accident that I began with radical evil. Right? That is the idea of the bar as the infinite gap between morality. So Hegel wants to say there's an in-between state in which it's not subject to the problems that are generated when you adopt the bar, either radically morally perfect or radically morally imperfect, structurally, metaphysically. So, but the intermediate state of an imperfect morality, which has shown itself to be the essential one, clearly shows that this observation, this supposed experience, is merely a dissemblance of the true state of the case. For since morality is imperfect, i.e. morality in fact is not, what can there be in the experience that morality fares badly? Since at the same time it has turned out that it is happiness simply as such that is involved, it is evident that in making the judgment that the immoral individual flourishes, it was not intended to imply that an injustice occurred there. Because if there is an injustice there, right, then there's a coordination problem at a different level, right? That we want justice and injustice at the level of happiness. The designation of an individual as immoral necessarily falls away when morality in general is imperfect and has therefore only an arbitrary basis. Therefore, the sense and content of the judgment of experience is solely this, that happiness simply as such should not have been the lot of some individuals, i.e. the judgment is an expression of envy which covers over itself in the cloak of morality. That is, you're a Kantian. You say, my duty is to do the moral law. What's the deal? Either you think your duty is to do the moral law, so what is the status of happiness for you? What is really the status of that? And you see the bad guy flourishing. And are you morally outraged? No. You want happiness. I mean, it's happiness that you're seeking there. And therefore, what you've done, and I want to be clear here, is you've separated moral goodness and natural goodness, so that they are in totally different registers, and therefore that there is no intrinsic coordination between morality and happiness, and then you're complaining about it. Right? So that the idea of trying to put a moral cloak over it, Hegel is actually a symptom of the deeper issue, that you've already put happiness, that is nature, outside morality. So, of course, when you want to bring happiness back in, since it doesn't have a autonomous moral weight, the real source is that you want it. You just want it. So, the status of happiness becomes fraught. It becomes the problem of moral luck. And to say that it's a matter of moral luck is already to say that this is a stoical system. So it's the stoicism that both wants happiness and doesn't want it. That's the real contradiction. They're both thinks happiness matters and can't really own up to how happiness matters because it's already devalued it as morally worthy. If the goal of morality was not simply perfect your will, but say, have all human beings flourishing and happy, it would look very different. So, this very problem of what I call liberal guilt, comes exactly out of the both denial and assumption of happiness. The same problem happened again with the second postulate, namely, how do I want to put this one? Of course, it is simply false to say, as some people accuse Kant of saying, that you can only act morally when you don't want to do it. Kant does not require you to only struggle against your inclination. However, there is a metaphysical truth to that claim, namely, it's the temptation of Vilcour to choose against reason that is constitutive of morality in general. And because that's the case, Kant cannot conceive, Kant cannot conceive of spontaneously, naturally desiring, just desiring to do the right thing. Because if you always spontaneously desire to do the right thing, then you would be moral, right? And he actually says this, that of course, he says, you can, you know, train people to have spontaneous natures. He says, that's good. It's not a bad thing that there are people who are, out of their human kindness, decent and moral, in quotes. But it's not really moral. Why? Because all this belongs to nature. So because it belongs to nature, if they're doing the right thing spontaneously and desiring it, is of no moral significance. So the same problem with the realization problem happens here. The problem of happiness, I achieved happiness, no I didn't. Okay, I desire, I simply see he's unhappy and I'm sorry, baby. That's it. And then I say, oh no, I didn't mean I spontaneously desired. I know that if I'm to be a really good person, I must make, you know, so that's not the deep thing. The deep thing is the goal. So again, I shift back and forth. It's the shifting and dissemblance again about whether this particular act is what matters or the end goal that matters. And now we can see why he has a problem between the moral law itself and all the particular laws. Because all this account of shifting and dissemblance is just this conflict between universal and particular. And it's a conflict between universal and particular because particular actions can both achieve happiness and be done spontaneously. And therefore, particular actions, right, can make the moral metaphysics disappear completely. So Kant has to say, and he does say, in the very first chapter of the Radical Work, we do not know if anyone has ever, in the history of the world, done a moral deed. Why does he say that? Well, part of it is strictly Freudian, right? He just thinks the human heart is dark, opaque. We don't know what people's true motives are. But he also thinks, because we don't know what the true motives are, and that a moral action would only truly be a moral action If it was done for the right reason, then even though this person routinely says, "Are you okay?"
Yeah.
He seems to be doing morally good stuff. And Hegel wants to say, at what point, how do you, and Hegel's question is, how do you generate the skepticism here? And why not just say that someone who routinely does morally good actions is acting morally? Why say, "Oh, we don't know if they're really acting morally"? Well, what's the weight of "we don't know if they're really"? The deep voice, "really"? What's the source of the deep voice, "really"? The bar. The bar makes us into moral skeptics about ourselves. So we have to really keep wondering about our moral relations. I know I was trying to help the students, but really, what do I really think of students? Well, I have fantasies. And then you can go on and on, and how fantasies come in, and am I really a bad person because I think these terrible things about me? No! So, now, what's terrible about all this for Hegel is that it generates a form of hypocrisy and dissemblance, right? His worry, of course he's worried about the moral metaphysics. And the next step is to close this gap completely. And he calls that conscience. And we'll start there next week. But what his objection to Kant is that this way of thinking about morality continually has a double thought about each moment. So it both will emphasize the concrete moment and brag about it, but then if you kind of press it, it says, no, that's not the deep thing. The deep thing is the ultimate goal. And it can't stop this restless to-ing and fro-ing, which comes a kind of self-beratement, a form of distrust, a form of moral anxiety. So, of all things, the desire to act morally makes you into a dissembling, shifty, not to be trusted, never trusted. Okay, we'll stop there.